Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith. Today we will hear part one of a community radio and TV producer's interview with former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. The interview took place in West Hartford after his January 24, 2006 talk at the town hall there. Ritter took the first question from Helda Mira of Newspeak TV.
Helda Mira of Newspeak TV from Hartford Public Access. How did you first get involved with being one of the main UN inspectors in Iraq?
Well, I mean, we need to, I guess, set the stage. In April 1991, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution, 687, which mandated the disarmament of Iraq and created a weapons inspection entity, the United Nations Special Commission, to go in and oversee this work. Initially, the concept was that it would be your typical arms control agreement, a gentleman's agreement per se, where the Iraqis would submit a declaration listing the totality of their holdings of weapons of mass destruction, and the UN inspectors would go in and verify the completeness of this declaration and oversee the disposition of the material that was declared. Unfortunately, the Iraqi government took a decision not to submit a full declaration. They submitted a declaration that only declared half of Iraq's capabilities in chemical weapons and ballistic missiles, totally denied having a biological weapons program or a nuclear weapons program. And so now you create a problem. You see, the organizational structure of the inspectors was designed to receive information from Iraq, not to actively search for information. And so the rules of the game were changed, and now they had to create, they being the UN weapons inspectors, create this new entity that dealt with intelligence information, with receiving intelligence data from member states around the world, collating this, assessing it, and then deriving from that data which could be used to drive inspections. This is completely different from the kind of technical-based inspection that the inspectors were organized to do. You know, you have your nuclear physicists, you have your chemists, your biologists, your rocket scientists are going in to do this technical job of disarmament, and now you're saying, well, wait a minute, we've got to throw in a little James Bond there. They're not trained, equipped, or motivated to do that kind of work. And that's where somebody like myself gets involved. You know, I'm not a nuclear physicist. I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a biologist. I'm a spy. I'm an practitioner of the art of espionage. For 12 years, I did intelligence for the United States Marine Corps. I'm somebody who had a background in Iraq. I was the Iran-Iraq War analyst for the Rapid Deployment Component of the United States Marine Corps in the 1980s. I was a weapons inspector in the former Soviet Union for 2 years, implementing the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And I was somebody who took the lead in the counter-SCUD campaign in the 1991 Gulf War, trying to interdict Iraqi missiles before they get launched against Israel. And so when the United Nations said, hey, we need to create this capability, there was an Army colonel there, Doug England, who I worked for when I was in the former Soviet Union. He knew that I was available. He called me up and said, we have this job. We need somebody with your mix of skills. Would you like to come and do it? It was only supposed to be a two-month job. I was supposed to come in and set this program up, and then it would be turned over to a Canadian who would run it, and I would go away. I said, sure, I'd be more than happy to do it. I came in 2 months later. The UN obviously liked what they saw, and they asked me to stay on. They gave me a six-month extension. That six-month extension turned into a full-time job that lasted 7 years, and that's how I got involved. Initially, I was just supposed to be an intelligence analyst, but I'm an intelligence professional, and I'm also a former Marine Corps officer, and they have a saying in the Marine Corps, leadership abhors a vacuum, and if the Marine Corps does one thing with its officers, it makes them leaders. And you come into this entity called the United Nations, and you see there's just a ton of work that needs to be done, and nobody's doing it. Everybody's sitting around their desk waiting to be told what to do. Well, you don't have to tell me to do anything. I'll just do it. If a job needs to be done, you get it done. And as a result, at a very young age with some good experience but not high-level experience, I'm suddenly being drawn in and running programs that are international in scope and scale, which play a critical role in international peace and security. I'm not doing it because I'm the most highly qualified person. I'll never make that claim for anything. I'm doing it because no one else is doing it. And it's a job that needed to be done, so you step forward. And what's interesting, when you do a job that's never been done before, you do it once, you become the expert, because you're the only one who's done it. And if you do it 20 times, you become the ultimate expert. And that's what happened there. Iraq and inspections, the kind of inspections we were running in Iraq is a very niche type operation. It's unique. There's no competitor around the world doing the same thing. And so, you know, when you get called upon to do this job, you know, after a while, you become the only person who can do it. Whether you're doing a good job or not, you're the only one who can do it. And I think that's what occurred vis-a-vis myself in Iraq. We had this unique type job. It evolved in a certain manner, and I was the guy doing it. And I sort of became the sole resource available to the international community. That doesn't necessarily make me, you know, somebody who walks on water and is infallible. It just meant I was the only one who had the experience doing it.
What kept you from going back specifically during this lead up to the current war? And why weren't you listened to by the current administration?
We need to understand that when I was an inspector from 1991 to 1998, and the presidential administrations that I interfaced with were Bush 41, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Bill Clinton. You know, I left the job in 1998. George W. Bush didn't arrive on the scene until November 2000. And so when the Bush administration was making its push for war, you know, I'm not in an official capacity. I am, you know, somebody who, you know, joins a whole host of former officials or former, you know, this or that, who become talking head pundits. And sometimes talking head pundits can be useful in disseminating information to a broader audience, but very rarely are they listened to by policymakers. Policymakers have their own little inner circle of people who, you know, have an ideology, who have a political motivation, they have a policy objective, and they have the U.S. intelligence community to draw upon to get their data and information. So, you know, it would be, you know, sort of the ultimate expression of hubris to say, you know, they should have listened to me. I was a guy that they had to listen to. It would have been nice if people had at least heeded some of the warnings that were being put out there, a hesitancy to embrace so willingly data about the existence of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction that didn't make any sense. I mean, I'm somebody who had this 7-year experience, you know, a unique experience, an in-depth experience on hands, on the ground, you know, looking at weapons of mass destruction. I'm finding inconsistencies in the Bush administration's logic, and I'm trying to articulate, you know, my concern. It would have been nice if somebody had said, hey, let's investigate that, let's push on. But, you know, what we found out is that the Bush administration wasn't interested in disarmament. They would only listen to me if they were truly interested in disarmament. They had made a policy decision to remove Saddam Hussein from power, and they were using the issue of weapons of mass destruction as a facilitator to sell a war. And so what I was saying was completely inconvenient to their larger policy objectives.
It's since come out in a few different forms that the invasion had been on the table even before the regime change. You brought it up in your speech, but that's essentially been on the table through the Clinton administration. And something that a woman stated in her question almost alluded to, that the idea of 9/11 as just being another excuse for this to occur. How do you see that working into what you just discussed about they basically didn't want to listen to you and had something set up in the greater scheme of their plan to do this, to essentially invade Iraq and hold it? And you made some very good points yesterday, which I personally was unaware of how the Clinton administration works into continuing and maintaining the sanctions that were there.
Well, the first thing we have to do is differentiate between the policy of regime change as articulated and implemented by Bush 41 and Clinton and the policy of regime change that was acted on by George W. Bush. We use the term regime change, but in reality, what Bush 41 and what Clinton wanted wasn't regime change, but name change. You see, regime change means you want to get rid of the Ba'athist Party. You want to change the way Iraq is run. You want to totally transform that society. Nobody in the original Bush administration, George Herbert Walker Bush, or in the first, you know, 6 years of the Clinton administration, were saying we're going to get rid of the Ba'athists. In fact, what they wanted was a coup d'état to take place from within by a Sunni general who, you know, could look like Saddam, talk like Saddam, walk like Saddam, act like Saddam, just as long as his name wasn't Saddam Hussein. So the original policy objective was more like name change, not regime change. And why is this important? Because it shows that the impetus for the American policy is more about domestic American politics than it is about national security. See, if Iraq poses a threat, it's the regime that poses a threat, not Saddam Hussein. But we're not saying get rid of the regime. We're saying get rid of the man, and we can replace him with somebody who does the exact same things, but his name isn't Saddam. Saddam was a political problem. And this is important when you take a look at how the Clinton administration, you know, behaved. They inherited a policy from George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush is the one that initiated this political embarrassment for the presidency by calling for Saddam Hussein's ouster, by saying that he's Hitler, saying he's evil, saying he must be removed, and then not acting on that. That's an embarrassment for a president. He had big plans on how to get rid of Saddam Hussein after the 1992 election. But the first thing Bush needed to do was win that election. He didn't. Clinton came in. Now, Clinton said, you know, this is bad policy. I don't like this policy. I think we should find a way to bring Iraq into the family of nations and do away with these sanctions. But he wasn't allowed to act on that. The Bush administration, again, George Herbert Walker Bush's administration, you know, cooked up an escalation of tension between Iraq and the United States that on the day Bill Clinton was being sworn in as the president, 42nd president of the United States, American aircraft were bombing Iraq and being shot at by Iraqi air defenses. How can a president talk about some grand new sweeping reform of Iraq-U.S. relations while we're at war with Iraq? So it was deliberately done by the Bush administration to make it virtually impossible for Clinton to have this bold new policy. When Clinton said, I'm going to push forward with this bold new policy, then they came up with the next roadblock, which was the alleged assassination attempt of George Herbert Walker Bush in Kuwait in 1993. The Kuwaiti government, you know, exposed this plot, put the plotters out there. They confessed that they were ordered by Iraqi intelligence to assassinate the president, etc. And Clinton acted on it by firing cruise missiles at the Iraqi intelligence services. Now, when you act on something, you give it a credibility, you give it a legitimacy. But, you know, when the FBI went in and talked to these alleged plotters, the first thing they did is recant their confession, said, we were tortured. We're not assassins. We're smugglers. We've been smuggling for years. We got caught, and they've set us up. Back then, the United States didn't embrace torture, so the confessions were tossed. The FBI does a forensic investigation of the explosives and finds that the explosives matched lot numbers of explosives brought in by the Iraqi government when they invaded in 1990, but were left behind in Kuwait by the Iraqi government when they left. So that from 1991 to 1993, these explosives that these Iraqi assassins were supposed to use were actually under the control of the Kuwaiti government. And now today, we've captured all of the Iraqi intelligence personnel that we said were responsible for the plot. We've captured the documentation archive, and there's no evidence whatsoever of Iraqi government plans to assassinate the president. All the Iraqi intelligence people say it never happened, but Clinton acted on it and therefore gave it a legitimacy in the mindset of the American people, which means Clinton cannot change or deviate from this policy. So Clinton inherits this policy, but he's not serious about taking out Saddam. He doesn't see it as a big deal. So he does nothing. We just keep the sanctions in place. In order to keep the sanctions in place, though, you have to maintain the public perception of a non-compliant Iraq. So the biggest enemy facing the United States isn't Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. It's the UN weapons inspectors who are saying, hey, we think we're coming to a closure on this. We think we're disarming Iraq. We think there's no more weapons left. See, we're the threat. Because if you disarm Iraq, you got to lift the sanctions. If you lift the sanctions, you break containment. If you break containment, Saddam comes back into the fold of the international community in place, which is a political embarrassment to the president. And to prove that, you know, this issue of, you know, the politicization of Iraq, just take a look at 1994. Newt Gingrich and the Republicans sweep into the Congress and start beating up President Clinton for his inability or unwillingness to deal with Saddam Hussein. And they say, look, you yourself say he's a big threat. You yourself says he has a weapons program, but you're doing nothing about it. So now Clinton has a problem because he's facing the 1996 election. And so he turns to the CIA and says, I want this guy gone by early 1996. I don't want him to be a player in the election. So now the CIA ups the ante, aggressively goes after Saddam Hussein. For what reason? Because Saddam poses a threat to the United States? No, because Saddam's continued existence is a political threat to the president of the United States. Well, the coup failed in 1996. Clinton, you know, sputters along. In 1998, the Republicans use, again, Clinton's weakness on the Saddam issue to force Congress to pass what's called the Iraq Liberation Act, which set aside $98 million of U.S. taxpayers' funds to support opposition forces to overthrow Saddam Hussein. So it became official stated policy. Regime change. And again, regime change requires containment, which requires Inspectors say there are no weapons, but when the inspectors are saying there, or the inspectors say there are weapons, but when the inspectors say there are no weapons, we become the problem. So they have to undermine the credibility of the inspectors. An important thing about the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, though, is that it specifically prohibits the use of American military force to overthrow Saddam Hussein. So even though George W. Bush inherits a policy of regime change and the policy of lying about WMD to maintain economic sanctions, he still needed a trigger to take it to the next step because everybody knew that the opposition forces weren't viable. They had no constituency inside Iraq. They were never going to get rid of Saddam Hussein. So if you truly want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, it is going to require U.S. military intervention on a massive scale. The American people weren't going to support that unless you have a trigger. 9/11 became that trigger. After 9/11, the Bush administration radically changed its approach to dealing with Saddam Hussein. They shifted away from supporting the opposition groups and covert action to direct military intervention on the part of the United States to remove Saddam Hussein from power. This could not have happened. This policy shift could not have happened unless you had a 9/11 type event.
The FBI's discovery that the quote-unquote assassination attempt on former President Bush, when did the FBI sort of discover that?
Well, the FBI did their investigation in 93, 94, 95. And then the CIA has put forward its own internal review in the aftermath of the March 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq. And so the totality of this data clearly shows that there was never an assassination attempt against George Herbert Walker Bush. This was a cooked-up event. People blame the Kuwaiti government and say, well, they're the ones who cooked it up. But I would like to see a deeper investigation to find out if there's any culpability on the part of the former administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, which means Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, and other officials who, in post-September 11, 2001, became the primary architects for the decision to invade Iraq.
One of the biggest sound bites, if you will, was George W. Bush saying, well, this is the guy that tried to kill my dad.
Yeah.
Excuse me for the bad impression, but it's hard to not do.
I think you said daddy.
Daddy, okay. In all of that, we see an administration that, A, to begin with, is almost illegally placed within the American government because of the fact that the Supreme Court essentially trumped the Constitution and placed them there. Do you, as someone who, a card-carrying member of the Republican Party, do you see this as just a complete affront and violation of the Constitution and of the American trust, what this administration has done? And do you see them, therefore, almost guilty of war crimes? And should they be, should anything of that matter be discovered and go beyond impeachment?
We need to be careful here because we're talking about some very serious charges. And one of the wonderful things about being an American is that we are a nation that's governed by the rule of law. And a key component of the rule of law is the notion of due process. And so, I have a lot of animosity to the Bush administration, but I'm not going to convict them of a crime until there's been due process. I will charge them with, the fact that I feel that lies were told. Now, that's not a war crime. To have government officials tell lies in the conduct of his or her official duty, it's not a war crime. It's a civil crime. It's actually a felony. If you're found guilty of lying under oath as a government official during the conduct of your duties, that's a felony. And I do believe that a serious case can be made that the senior most elements of the Bush administration lied when they presented the case for war with Iraq to the American public, to the Congress of the United States. I can also say, and I had an interesting discussion with Democratic staffers of the Judiciary Committee who want me to help them go after the Bush administration. I said, sure, I'll help you. But if you Democrats target the Republican Bush administration, regardless of the legitimacy of your complaints, it's going to be seen as partisan politics. No one's going to support it. If you really want support, broaden it. Indict Madeleine Albright. Indict Sandy Berger. Indict the members of the Clinton administration that told the exact same lies to the Congress of the United States and the American people. Because it's not just the Bush administration that's been telling the lies. The Clinton administration did. Where you can get the Bush administration where it's different is the concept of war crimes. But again, we have to be careful here because when we start saying war crimes, we're really speaking about violations of international law. And the last thing I as an American want, and I have to be frank and say I will never tolerate it, is an international tribunal holding my elected officials accountable to the rule of law. Because just think about that for a second. What does that mean? It means we, the people of the United States, have failed. means we're not capable of self-governance. We're not capable of enforcement of our own laws. It means the Constitution of the United States is irrelevant in the mind of the American people. We have to have the world hold our officials accountable. That means we have failed. And to be honest, the only way it's going to happen is if America gets defeated. And that won't happen while I'm alive. I will fight to the death to make sure America never gets defeated by any threat out there. What I can't accept is the notion that our government officials are therefore above the law, above the rule of law, above international law. It is applicable, especially when you have an American Supreme Court justice, Judge Jackson in 1946 in the Nuremberg Tribunal, holding the German government accountable for planning and waging war of aggression. That was called by Judge Jackson the ultimate war crime, because from that war crime, all other crimes put forward. And in charging the Germans put up an act of defense of preemptive attack. They said, they took out the whole time period of the German aggression. But one of the interesting parts is where they talked about Denmark and Norway and the decision by the Germans to go into Denmark and Norway. You know, the Germans made a very viable argument that they were at war. You know, this is before they gassed the Jews. This is before they invaded the Soviet Union. This is back when they're fighting a war with France and England, sort of your just typical European war. And the British and the French are getting ready to send troops into Norway and Denmark to cut off Germany's strategic line of communication with Sweden's resources. The Germans said we had no choice but to go into Denmark and Norway to secure our lines of communication during a time of war. It was a preemptive attack. And this was rejected by the Nuremberg Tribunal, by Judge Jackson. They said, no, this isn't preemptive. There is no justification for preemptive war. What you did is plan and wage an illegal war of aggression. Now, if we're going to hold the Germans accountable and reject preemptive attack, we have to do the same to the Bush administration. The Bush administration has used preemption as a defense for going into Iraq. And what we find is that there was no threat from Iraq that warranted the preemptive defense. But even if there was, preemption in itself has been rejected, even when you can make a viable case that there is a threat out there. But there was no threat from Iraq. So the preemptive attack defense even goes away. You can't even mitigate this crime by saying, Bush at least thought it was required. This was the equivalent of cold, premeditated murder. And we must hold the Bush administration accountable for this. We, the people of the United States, must hold Bush accountable, not an international community, not an international tribunal. We must hold him accountable. And we can do that through due process. And the due process is we impeach him, and then we hold him accountable to the U.S. courts. That's the process I'd like to see play out. You know, we have to be careful about finding him guilty before there's due process. I would like to see the Congress of the United States initiate a serious investigation into the allegations that George W. Bush and his administration not only committed serious felony-level civil crimes by lying to the American people, but have committed crimes against humanity and war crimes by violating international law that the United States had signed on to, which means violating the Constitution of the United States, because Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution clearly states that when we enter into a treaty or international agreement that's ratified by two-thirds of the United States Senate, that is the supreme law of the land. George W. Bush, as the senior executive of the United States of America, has no remit to violate the Constitution of the United States of America, and he has done so egregiously.
Mr. Ritter, Dory Smith, Talk Nation Radio. Newsnight at the BBC had a mock tribunal recently, and they put the Allies on trial for war crimes. People like Dar Jamil testified and talked about Fallujah, where he talked about collective punishment, use of snipers, making the area a free fire zone. The jury found the Allies guilty of war crimes. The audience emailing in to vote also found the Allies guilty of war crimes. Now, I know you've just participated in a tribunal also in New York. Please talk about the possible value of having a televised tribunal to sort these matters out in front of the court of public opinion.
The British public is significantly better equipped with knowledge and information to form responsible judgments on the issue. If we were ever to hold a tribunal like that here in the United States without significant preparatory work on both the part of the media to inform the public and on the public to, A, recognize their legitimate roles and responsibilities as citizens. You see, we have too many people who don't recognize the importance of citizenship in their role. They're more consumer-oriented. They're just waltzing around this country, not engaged. So it's a waste of time to try and approach somebody who's not engaged, because even if you get them to engage, they're going to engage on the basis of ignorance and probably have a knee-jerk, ideologically motivated reaction, which will happen regardless of the data that you put forward. I don't think this would succeed in the United States, because I don't think the American people are prepared to receive this data. I don't think the media is equipped to disseminate the data. And the way the polarization of the American body politic today is such that you couldn't have an impartial trial. It would break down on ideological lines, where you would have anti-Bush people saying war criminal, and you'd have pro-Bush people saying hero, and the facts simply wouldn't matter. So I think it would be an exercise in futility at this point in time. It would be something that would be nice to have, you know, but I think in terms of a public process, it would fail. In England, it succeeded. In the United States, I think it would fail.
Mr. Ritter, John Holder from WWH. I'm curious, could you talk about that a little bit more? Why is the American public so ill-prepared to discuss the substantive issues in terms of international law and culpability?
The American public doesn't understand international law. The American public, you know, and again, there's going to be individuals out there who take violent exception to say, hey, I understand international law, but you're not the American public. You're an individual. Let's talk about the public at large. You know, when you take a look at your average American citizen, if I put up a map of the United States, they'd be hard-pressed to name the 50 states. They'd be hard-pressed to talk about what the significant economic, factors are in different sectors of America. They don't even know their own country. I could take up a map of the state and ask them to name the counties. Most people might not even be able to tell me what the capital of their respective state is, what the chief economic aspects of their state is, who their elected representatives are, what's the name of their governor, what party is their governor from, who are their congressmen, who are their senators. They don't know. And now we expect them to understand the complexities of the world? Sit there and say, tell me about Iraq? You have PhDs who have studied the Middle East and Iraq who still don't understand Iraq. And yet we want the American public to suddenly weigh in on the issue of Iraq, on the Middle East, on Palestinian-Israeli conflict, on Europe, on Asia, the significance of the growth of China's economy. America, you know, for the technologically advanced nation it is populated by the single most ignorant people on the face of the earth. We have all this power, but this power isn't matched with responsibility. We have this power that seems to be propelled by ignorance. And this ignorance is easily manipulated, because from ignorance comes fear. And that fear now can be played on by politicians. They can push the fear button. And we've seen that in post-9/11. The Republicans have been brilliant in exploiting the fear generated by 9/11 to pursue both an aggressive foreign policy agenda, but also an aggressive domestic policy agenda. And we not only have the Patriot Act now that's in play, we have the Department of Homeland Security, and we have this ridiculous mood ring of color codes that's put out there to dictate fear to the American people. And yet the people, I would say, don't understand these issues. We're just ill-equipped to do it. And it's our own fault. We've become addicted to consumerism, and we've forgotten what it means to be a citizen. We've forgotten the role and responsibility that each individual plays in this process. We don't hold our elected officials to account. We've basically abrogated our responsibility as citizen, and we've transferred the notion of governance and our role in governance to an elite. When that happens, we no longer function as a representative democracy. We become an oligarchy, where power is concentrated in the hands of a few. And oligarchy is trending in the wrong direction. It's not trending towards democracy. It's trending towards fascism. And what is fascism? But a combination of, national, military, and economic interests in the hands of a few who pursue, a very militaristic program. Well, if that isn't sort of the living, breathing definition of the role the United States is playing in the world today, I don't know what is. We live in very dangerous times, and the only thing that can reverse this trend is the intervention of the American people. but they're not equipped to intervene, and they're not prepared to intervene. They're not even inclined to intervene because they don't want to break out of this comfort of consumerism that they've constructed around themselves.
You've been listening to a press conference in West Hartford where community radio and TV producers in Connecticut were able to ask former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter questions about the Middle East, current events, and his latest book, Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam. Stay tuned for parts 2 and 3 of this discussion and listen to Talk Nation Radio Wednesdays at 5 p.m. I'm Dori Smith.